All right. Good morning, everybody. I think we have a quorum. Welcome to March 12th, 2026, to the Workforce Labor Economic Development Finance and Policy Committee. This morning, members and audience, we are going to be looking at some presentations to just help us sort of understand where we are at just from our demographics, from the studies, the information that we have, because as we make decisions in this committee, and we've talked about this a lot already, is to just get us grounded on where are things looking and what trends do we see. There's some positive trends, there's some concerning trends. Just want to kind of go around for that today. We don't have any bills to hear, so this should be we should be in and out of here at a regular time. I do want to let everybody know we have rules here at 10 a.m. this morning, so I want to try to wrap up by 5 to 10. So with that, that would be good. With our business at order here, I'm going to ask Representative Johnson Duluth, Pete Johnson, if I could, if you'd look at the minutes and if you could give us approval, please.
I did. Chair Baker, I'll move approval in the minutes.
Motion has been made to approve the minutes from yesterday, March 11th. Any questions, concerns? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Whoops, that was a quick. Minutes are passed. All right. Thank you very much. Our first presenter is Angelina Nguyen, she's on Zoom. Thank you very much. Okay. I want to welcome Angelina to the committee. If you can hear us okay, please introduce yourself and proceed.
Yes. Good morning, Chair Baker and committee members. Can you hear me okay?
We can hear you. Wonderful. Thank you. Yep.
Great. And I'm going to share my screen here. So good morning. Thank you for having me here. My name is Angelina Nguyen. I am Director of DEED's Labor Market Information Office, and my office works closely with the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics to collect, analyze, and publish data that track job growth and various labor metrics in Minnesota. I am here today to give an overview of Minnesota's labor market, its recovery since the COVID-19 pandemic, and how we compare to our neighboring states. So this is an overview of where things stand as of December. The latest data we have right now for at the state level is December 2025, and we will release newer data come next month. So as of December, Minnesota's labor force size is about 3.17 million workers. And of those, about 3,039,000 are employed and working, which leaves us with about 131,000 unemployed people looking for work. Our unemployment rate, our state's unemployment rate, is at 4.1%, which is within the bounds of what's considered a natural unemployment rate in the field of economics. This is the ideal spot to be, like between 3.5 and 4.5% for unemployment rate. And I'll go into this a little more detail later in the presentation. Minnesota also has one of the highest labor force participation rates in the country. It has held steady around 68%, shifting, you know, 0.1 or 0.2% here and there coming out of the pandemic. And the state has an estimated 3,068,000 jobs. So that's an overview of our labor market. Now, looking at jobs, our population, the point I want to make with this slide is that we have a robust job market given our population size. So our population ranks 22nd in the nation, and our jobs rank 18th in the nation, which reflects, again, our robust economy and high labor force participation rates. This is noteworthy compared to our neighbors. So looking at census data, Minnesota's population is about 5.8 million, And yet we, our jobs are 3,068,000. So the difference in our ranking between population and jobs is four ranks, which is significantly higher than our neighboring states who population and jobs ranking differ by one. And looking at job growth, I was asked specifically to talk about the post-pandemic years. So coming out of the pandemic, since 2021, Minnesota added almost 200,000 jobs, which is a 7% growth rate. This is a decent growth rate compared to our neighboring states, but it is lower than the nation's growth rate. And this is due to our state's aging population, which is have an older age distribution than the rest of the country as a whole. Economically, we see jobs grow, but the rate of growth is paced by labor availability. So in theory, if our population age distribution is similar to that of the nation, we would be able to grow, our jobs growth rate would be at a higher level. And in the years recovering from the pandemic, our year-over-year job growth rate has hovered between 1 to 2%. So it's still growing. It is an okay, a decent rate. It is just slower when you look at the country as a whole. And for the most part, Minnesota follows the macro trends that also affect our neighboring states. So as you can see, the Midwestern states are also experiencing, you know, aging population slower than desired job growth rate. Oh, wait, I'm going to skip this one because this is a different month. I'm sorry about that. And then looking at job change by sector, when we look at, when we break it down by industries, 14 out of 20 industries in Minnesota added jobs from 2021 to 2025. And as you, whenever you see industry breakdown for jobs growth or job vacancies, I want to point out that healthcare and social assistance sector is always at the top of the list for at least the last 5 years. It's a high growth, high demand industry, given our aging population. We've seen high demand for nursing home staff, nurses, nursing assistants, physicians, the full range of occupations related to medical care and healthcare. And the good thing I also want to point out on this slide is Minnesota's economy is diverse and balanced. We do not rely on any single industry for our growth. So it's very well set up. That we have a diverse range of industries that boost our economy. The majority of the big industries experience growth coming out of the pandemic, and that is a strength for our state. 6 out of 20 industries saw job losses in the last 4 years, and they are finance and insurance, administrative support and waste management services, management of companies, and the information industry. And these four industries tend to see job loss over the year for these four for a while now. And then going on to the labor side, I'm going to talk a little bit about our unemployment in the state. So right after the pandemic, like between 2022 and 2023, Minnesota had a very tight labor market. At that time, our unemployment rate was historically low, and our economy needed workers. Like, we had more job vacancies than we had workers to fill them. And over the last year, we've seen the unemployment rate inch up, and the labor market is now, I would no longer call it tight. As of December, our unemployment rate was 4.1%. And like I mentioned earlier, this is this is okay. This is a natural, around the natural unemployment rate. It's a sweet spot where we want to be. And as of now, December, our labor market is more, is closer to a balance point where for every job vacancy we have 0.9 job seeker. So almost a one-to-one ratio. And ranking against other states, we rank in the middle. Our neighboring states tend to have very, very low unemployment rate, like as you can see, the Dakotas. In terms of how much our unemployment rate grew over the year, we saw the third largest increase in the country. It shot up 1.1% between December 2024 and December 2025. So this is an interesting situation. On the one hand, it's good to have unemployed job seekers to fill labor demand. On the other hand, it makes you question why did our number of unemployed grow so much over the last year. So in December, we had 131,000 unemployed workers, and we added 38,000 unemployed people to that number over the year. So a jump of almost 41%. In comparison, the U.S. had 7.5 million unemployed workers, and over the year added about 617,000, so a 9% increase. And our neighboring states saw much smaller increases of unemployed workers. So the trend of growing unemployment is shared across the nation. It's just for Minnesota, we had a bigger jump in unemployment than our neighbors. So there are a couple of reasons behind this. One is Minnesota has seen an increase of people entering the workforce over the past year. The demographic data we have show that many unemployed individuals are men, but also a lot of them are women as well. A lot of them are teenagers. And then in terms of racial breakdown, white workers and Black workers we saw had a growth in unemployment. And also people who have completed high school or completed a college degree. And interestingly, we actually saw a decline in the unemployment rate or in the unemployment number of Hispanic workers and those with a partial college education. And this is just comparing year to year. So this is just speaking of the last year, not in general. And then the second reason for this for growing unemployment in the last year is we've seen that last year's hiring is lower than in previous years. Deed conducts an employer experience survey from which we hear employers saying that there are more candidates applying to their vacancies, but many of them don't have the right skills to fill the job. So this is a shift from what you would have heard from employers in 2022, 2023, where the labor market was so tight that they were more willing to train people on the job or to be okay with, like, say, work experience in lieu of educational attainment. And as the labor market swings back in the favor of employers, we usually would hear employers being more or able to be more picky in their hiring. And again, I'm going to revisit the demographics a little bit. When we look into the demographic details of unemployed individuals, we see that the labor market has become more difficult for women. That was very clear. There were fewer women in the labor force, so their size decreased, and those who remained, more of them were unemployed. So their unemployment rate, the women's unemployment rate increased. We also see a big jump for Black workers entering the labor market. About 28,000 Black workers joined the labor market, and we, about half of them, we saw an increase in unemployment. And then for white workers, their numbers decline, like their labor force numbers decline by about 9,000, but the number of unemployed increased by about 16,000. And similarly for teenagers, their numbers in the labor force dropped by about 17,000 workers, but the number of unemployed teens increased by about 7,000. So this indicates that there are less jobs available for teenagers. Usually, when the labor market is in need of workers, you see more teens, taking jobs and becoming employed or entering the job market. And when the labor market goes the other way, where there are less jobs available, the first group to be affected are one of the first groups to be affected are teenagers. And looking at labor force size, our labor force size has slowly, very slowly, but consistently grew every year since the pandemic. So it's a good thing that it's growing. We added 110,000 workers since 2021, which is a 3.6% increase. It's a slower growth rate. As I've mentioned before, it's a slower growth rate than the nation's rate of 6%. And it's kind of in the middle of the pack compared to our neighboring states. When we talk about labor force, it's important to remember that this includes people who are working as well as unemployed people who want to work and are looking for work. And we want a continuously growing labor force. That's the first step to sustaining a healthy economy. And we also want individuals in the labor force to be working. So that means two things. One, there has to be jobs to fill. So we want to make sure that the job creation rate is stable and good. And two, the workers need to have the right skills to match job demands. So it's things to keep in mind for the committee. In terms of labor force participation rate, this is talking about the proportion of non-institutionalized civilians age 16 plus who are working or looking for work. And Minnesota's labor force participation rate has been hovering steady at around 68%, like I've mentioned before. And as of December, we ranked fifth in the nation for highest labor force participation rate at 68.2%. And this is a commonality among Western states. Three out of four of our neighboring states also have very high labor force participation rate. And the national rate is almost 6% lower at 62.4%. In terms of how our labor force participation rate has changed over the last year, so our rate, Minnesota's rate, rose 0.2% over the year, so ranking 18th for highest rate increase. Iowa and North Dakota also saw a rate increase, and they ranked fourth and respectively in the country for rate increase. Whereas South Dakota and Wisconsin's labor force participation rate actually decreased over the year, so they ranked 32nd and 50th respectively. I want to stress that keeping Minnesota's labor force participation rate high is important for economic growth. And I joke that because of our climate, people, are in Minnesota to work, not to hang out. So maintaining an engaged labor force shouldn't be too hard for our state. And then lastly, it's worth noting that our labor force is becoming more racially diverse over time. It's still less racially diverse than the country as a whole, but it's more diverse than our neighboring states. So since 2021, the number of white workers declined by about 13,000, and the number of workers of races other than white increased over 75,000. Workers of other races had higher labor force participation rate, almost 7% higher than the state's rate, which, as you recalled, was already ranking fifth highest in the nation. However, workers of color experienced higher unemployment rates. And what this means is they're willing to work and looking for work, but they're having a harder time getting work. And that's what I have prepared. Thank you for having me this morning, and I'm happy to take questions if you have any.
Thank you very much, Ms. Nguyen. I do have one question, and I'll look for other members if they have one too. A couple of years ago, we started paying unemployment insurance for people under the age of 18. I think that was a new thing for Minnesota. Did that affect how we're tracking when people are entering the workforce? So you were saying how Minnesota's workforce and entry, are you tracking them after a certain age? If a person starts a job at 16 years old, whether they're getting any unemployment insurance or not, my question is, in that law change in 2023, are we tracking anything that would have skewed these numbers at all because we're tracking younger people differently?
Yes. Thanks, Chair Baker. To answer that question, no. That law change would not have affected our stats because, so this is coming from a survey of households for the employment and unemployment as of looking from the workers' perspective. It's based on a survey of households, of 900 households in Minnesota. And labor force, like when we say someone entered the labor force or the labor force grew, it is looking at all civilians who are not in institutions, age 16 or older. Okay. So that criteria, that definition has not changed over time. So any changes in unemployment insurance eligibility would not affect how we measure labor force size or labor force participation rate.
Very good. Thank you. Other member questions? Seeing none. Ms. Nguyen, thank you very much for this information. Very helpful, and to see how we kind of compare next to our neighbors, this was really helpful. Thank you so much.
Yes, thank you for having me.
Members, next up, I would like to call Ms. Shothorse to the table, to the testifying table, to present to us sort of the benchmarks report overview. We have maybe seen these in different kinds of settings before, but I wanted to take some time to just see what they're seeing. This has been kind of an annual report that we see every year. And again, I just want to welcome you today, let you get set up there, and you can introduce yourself and proceed when you're ready. And welcome.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Lauren Shothorst. I'm the Director of Workplace Management and Workforce Development Policy for the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce, a statewide business organization representing 6,300 businesses and over 500,000 employees across Minnesota. The majority of our members are small and mid-sized businesses. Thank you for having me here today to share the findings from our 2026 Business Benchmarks Report as it relates to Minnesota's workforce competitiveness. Before diving into the data on workforce trends, I wanted to provide some context on what we're seeing in the broader trajectory of the state's economy, and then look at how migration plays into this bigger economic picture. Last November, the Minnesota Chamber released our 2026 Business Benchmarks reports, and that report is in your packets today. That report summarized and distilled some key trends emerging across several years of focused research into Minnesota's overall competitiveness, and prompted our organization to launch the Economic Imperative for Growth, an urgent call to action so Minnesota can reach its economic potential. First, the good news. A main takeaway is that Minnesota consistently ranks highly across a wide variety of measures that reflect economic health and quality. We are consistently in the top 5 to 10 states in a long list of metrics around innovation, education levels, our diverse economy base, and so forth. But at the same time, the data is clear that our overall economic growth has been decelerating for some time. Our economy is growing slower than it used to, and in recent years has moved from around the middle of the pack to the bottom 10 to 15 states. What's holding us back? There are a number of factors that can help answer this question, and not everything is in Minnesota's control, so to speak. But state policy certainly is a factor, and Minnesota's business climate and cost concerns have created real competitive disadvantages. Every day during session, my colleagues and I are in committees across the Capitol testifying to this fact. Just earlier this week, I was before this committee discussing the economic impacts of the new paid family and medical leave mandate on our business community, as an example. Minnesota's cost of doing business is outpacing the United States in key areas, and this impacts both employers and employees. You can see this clearly in GDP per capita, one of the broadest measures of prosperity. It's the metric used to compare the wealth of countries, states, and regions. Minnesota used to be ahead of the national average for decades, but in the first half of this decade, Minnesota's per capita GDP has grown at just 1% annually, ranking us 38th now among states. So the advantage has been erased. Why should you care about this negative trend and work with us to reverse it? Economic growth grows the economic pie, and a growing economic pie means increases in income, purchasing power, investment, jobs, and innovation. It generates resources for individuals and for communities and for the state and local governments, easing pressure on social safety nets. Growth signals optimism, and people want to live, work, and play in places with that kind of energy. Which brings me back to our economic imperative for growth and three key metrics we want to elevate from our 2026 Business Benchmarks report. To the first metric, growth per person is fundamentally driven by productivity. Productivity is the most important long-term driver of living standards, wage growth, and overall prosperity. It's the piece we should perhaps be the most focused on, but a healthy economy also requires growth in workforce and population. And here, Minnesota faces challenges. As you can see on this slide, our workforce has grown at just 0.2% annually in the first half of the decade, ranking 40th nationally from 2019 to 2024. Migration roles play a role in that. While there are both international and domestic components, Minnesota's more pronounced challenge has been on the domestic side, where we ranked 41st in net domestic migration this decade. So Minnesota remains strong in many respects, but we're not growing fast enough to sustain and build on the strengths developed over the decades. Let's look at the data. Since 2017, aside from the height of the pandemic, Minnesota has had roughly twice as many job openings as job seekers. Even into 2025, as economic conditions have cooled, we still see a structural shortfall in labor availability. Looking forward, our working age population is projected to grow very little through mid-century. The number of working age Minnesotans we have today is expected to be roughly the same in 10, 20, even 30 years from now. That means annual labor force growth is projected at just 0.2% through 2050. Unless labor demand declines outright, not just slows, but contracts, we are likely to remain in a structurally tight labor market. So where can workforce growth come from? It naturally comes down to three sources: natural population growth, more births than deaths, higher labor force participation among people already here, or net migration from other states and countries. Natural population growth has been slowing for years as birth rates decline. That's a trend that could change someday, but it's not projected to. So realistically, that leaves us with two levers: labor force participation and migration. On participation, there's actually good news. Minnesota's overall labor force participation remains among some of the highest in the country. We rank fourth or fifth nationally as of December. Participation among Minnesotans of color has increased by a remarkable 12 percentage points since 2011, a remarkable shift. Had participation remained at earlier levels, Minnesota would have roughly 100,000 fewer people in the workforce today. We've also seen meaningful gains among adults with disabilities. Remote work, workplace flexibility, and technology investments have expanded access to employment. These are important inclusion strategies. But here's the challenge. Because Minnesota already ranks near the top nationally in participation, we have less room to expand through this channel alone. There may be a natural ceiling we begin to approach. Which leads us to migration. Over the past 25 years, net international migration has been positive and increasingly important to population growth. Domestic migration has been more challenging. Minnesota has experienced negative net domestic migration in 20 of the past 25 years. So we need to ask, is this primarily a retention problem or an attraction problem? When we look at migration rates relative to population, Minnesota actually has a relatively low out-migration rate. A smaller share of our population leaves compared to many other states. The bigger issue is on the in-migration side. Minnesota has one of the lowest domestic in-migration rates in the country. That suggests this is primarily an attraction problem. geographically, the regional story matters. We see strong net gains from Illinois, but we experience net losses to neighboring states, North and South Dakota and Wisconsin, and to large Sunbelt states. And when we look at total flows, Wisconsin and North Dakota represent the largest two-way movement. That means even small improvements in regional competitiveness could materially affect outcomes. Age demographics also matter. The largest net negative migration occurs among recent high school graduates, young adults leaving for college or beginning their career elsewhere. It's not primarily retirees driving the trend. And as you can see on this side, 64% of high school graduates who leave Minnesota for college go to neighboring states. Importantly, this is also about attraction. It's less that we are losing tons of high school grads and more that we are not attracting large numbers of out-of-state college students. That brings us to the last question. What can Minnesota do to improve migration outcomes? Minnesota has strong pull factors, a highly innovative business sector, globally competitive firms, strong communities, high-quality job opportunities, high quality of life, and a dense network of colleges and universities anchored by the U and supported by strong private and two-year institutions. These are assets, but we also must consider possible push factors, cost of living, housing and childcare availability, and tax competitiveness. Minnesota ranks 44th in overall tax competitiveness. On cost of living measures, we rank 31st. Not the most expensive state, but not highly competitive either when compared to our regional neighbors like South and North Dakota, Iowa, and Wisconsin. In higher education sticker price affordability, Minnesota ranks 40th. And in housing growth, we rank 48th in new housing unit growth this decade. So if this is an attraction problem, cost structure and capacity likely play an important role. Now, I want to close on a note of cautious optimism. New census data shows that in 2025, Minnesota recorded a net positive domestic migration gain of about 8,000 people, the first positive year this decade. And in 2024, we were almost close to breaking even. So the last 2 years show measurable improvement. The question is whether this represents a durable shift or a temporary fluctuation. One possible contributing factor is higher education enrollment. Over the last 2 years, Minnesota has reversed a long-term enrollment decline and has outperformed the national average. If we are attracting more students and retaining more of them, that could be part of the story. It's too early to know definitively, but it's an encouraging signal. So let me leave you with four takeaways. First, growing Minnesota's workforce requires both inclusion and attraction. Participation gains have been real and important, but they will not be sufficient on their own. Second, regional competition matters. People are far more likely to move one state over than across the country, my personal experience notwithstanding. How we compete with our neighbors is critical. Third, young adults, particularly college age and early career individuals, are central to Minnesota's migration outcomes. Targeted efforts in that demographic could have outsized long-term impact. And finally, Minnesota has real strengths, innovation, strong communities, higher education assets, but we also face structural challenges around cost, competitiveness, and capacity that must be addressed if we want sustained population growth. I hope this presentation helps you think more deeply about how Minnesota positions itself for long-term workforce and population growth. Building a world-class workforce to grow Minnesota's economy requires us to beat labor force participations and increasing productivity benchmarks across the economy. And of course, adopting the Chamber's 2026 legislative priorities would improve the state's business competitiveness through accountable, balanced, and flexible state policy. Thank you for the opportunity to share our 2026 Business Benchmarks Report, and we hope you'll join our economic imperative for growth.
Thank you so much, Ms. Schotthorst, for this really good presentation. Very balanced, you struck me with one of your slides when you said, when we're already at sort of the top of the labor participation, it's much harder for us to grow more. And only we can only, I don't want to say we can only go one way, but it's harder to go up. And as I've been watching data for a number of years here, and everybody sitting at this table knows on both sides, I just want to make sure that we're competitive, and if we lose some and we don't win them all, and if we win some, we've got our best proposal on the table for anybody thinking about coming to Minnesota, but also those here to grow in Minnesota. And yet we're trying to build on decades and decades of really smart people in businesses and private investments, and it's going to be harder for us to get that to grow higher. And I just became aware of that today. It's just it's a fact that this is an important thing that we, to grow up at all in Minnesota, it's going to be a little bit more challenging because we've got so many already great things happening for us. I can't thank enough of the businesses and what they've done and invested in Minnesota. They could go into a lot of different places. So we're very, very fortunate that way to do this. So again, thank you for the report. Keeps us on track of where we're going, what's ahead. Excellent report. Thank you so much. Member questions. Co-Chair Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Ms. Schotthorst. It is really helpful and helpful to be reminded of the factors that lead to growth. You know, looking at labor force participation, as Chair Baker said, we're probably pretty near the max on that. And then increase migration, I suppose increase birth rates in the long run, which is maybe not something that you addressed. Maybe just to pause on that, I think recognizing that policies can impact that, you know, if people considering starting families, considering having children, feel supported in that, there are policies I think that can cause people that can impact those decisions. But then migration and then productivity. On the migration piece, I noticed you only briefly talked about international migration, and just I know the chamber has come out recently, I believe, but you can expand on this, in favor of federal immigration reform and encouraging greater migration. Can you talk about that, the chamber's position on that, and kind of what your thinking is when it comes to international migration, which has, I think, been a huge contributor to Minnesota's growth and success in recent decades?
Mr. Chair.
Ms. Shorkas. Yep.
Members of the committee. So the Chamber Foundation does a number of reports. I'm part of the Chamber. The Chamber Foundation is a separate entity but does a body of research, and the reports that you're mentioning on immigration can be found on our website. We periodically look at the economic contributions of immigrants to our economy and those types of things. So we do have a catalog of data and research on our website to some of these factors. In terms of our broader position on immigration, you've mentioned it's a federal issue. As a state chamber, primarily our policies are focused on the state capital, but one of the areas where we do engage at the federal level is on immigration reform, and it is to improve the process so that we can easily and legally have a pipeline of folks coming to the country and the state. The bottlenecks that I think everyone experiences is a contributing factor to our economic growth and the ease in which people can come into the country and the state for work purposes. So we go to Washington, D.C. annually and meet with the congressional delegation on this factor. It's not the area of jurisdiction that I cover personally for the chamber, but we do have a position in favor of comprehensive immigration reform at the federal level for the reasons stated.
Okay. Chair Pinto? Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks. Yeah, I'd recalled like in mid-February there being a pretty splashy announcement or a fair amount of news coverage that the chamber, Minnesota Chamber, was pushing for support for immigration, international migration, because it benefits Minnesota's competitiveness. So appreciate that, and maybe just to make sure that members of the committee are aware as well. And then I was reflecting on the, I guess, a couple slides. So there's the one early on where you've got, maybe we can go back to it. It's like maybe the third slide that says Minnesota has key economic advantages, which we definitely do. And as I look at these, you know, our state has for a long time been one that has had relatively higher taxes, relatively more regulation. I know we've been in committees, I think, a number of times, Michelle, or so I made this point, that we've also, as a state, over decades, had a stronger economic position and a healthier and happier populace based on all sorts of surveys and a lot of information. And when I look at this slide of Minnesota's key economic advantages, it seems like so many of these are founded in having had that higher tax, higher regulatory environment, just to put it, I mean, I don't know how else to put it. And when I combine this slide with the one about higher education, you know, in the last couple of years, we've made some investments to make sure that Minnesota residents can have greater access to higher education, just as an example. And I saw your slide later on talking about how Minnesota, we want to make sure that we're keeping those young people who are tending to leave our state. And the higher education is an area where enrollment's gone up. I guess maybe I'll ask you, do you view higher ed as a success story to a certain extent, in the idea that our state has in fact invested more there as there's been that kind of uptick in enrollment, and that we're trying to keep Minnesota young people in our state? Maybe you can talk about that piece, and then also just sort of the connection between tax of regulations and these key economic advantages that we're now drawing upon.
Ms. Shothorst.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, so for the first point, and I think the third point is they're aligned,
yeah.
When you're looking at the key economic advantages developed over time, Minnesotans do have a general inclination to understanding that they might pay a little bit more in exchange for high quality services. And what we're seeing is maybe a little bit of increased questioning the quality and the value of that connection. We are in the top 10 for, you know, business and individual tax rates. Do we think we're going to drop out of the top 10 in any time soon? That's our hope, but not to be 50th, right? So we joke, can we be 11th-iest on some of those metrics, meaning just a little less pressure. If you look at in the decades over time too, it's in competition with other states and what they've been doing with their tax policy that might have made things that we had previously put us in a competitive position lessening over time. And some of the metrics you're seeing is, you know, a look at that value proposition in Minnesota, but lessening over time in comparison to other states who are making aggressive moves to drive economic activity to their region by incentivizing business growth and development. In terms of investments, this is another great question, and I do think that you're seeing people valuing the education system and wanting, you know, businesses want investments made in places where they're seeing a return, and an educated workforce and those ready to work is one of those areas. The question is, does it net out at the end, and is it incentivizing what we want? We've seen those enrollment declines shift, which is a good thing. Our economist said it's too soon to tell if that's a long-term trend and something that we all should be watching on. And then are there additional state policies that could then be added to those investments to really ensure that folks benefiting from those investments stay, work, and live in Minnesota? And we have some ideas on that is up for a public policy debate too.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, that's helpful. I mean, and certainly the specifics matter, right? I mean, in any direction, whether it comes to taxes, regulation, spending, any of it. I guess I just reflect that we have these economic advantages that have been really strong. We also have not on this slide are things that we all, I think, care a lot about, as you say, sort of the well-being of the residents of our state. And it's certainly not as simple as, oh, we drop out of the top 10 and maybe we lose some of these advantages or lose some of that well-being. But also it's maybe not so simple. The details matter. What we do know is that over decades, our state has been in a different position. I will note, I think we've had a number of folks in your position maybe in past decades that have said when we've made those investments, hey, wait a second, this is going to threaten our economic competitiveness. We're going to lose our key economic advantages. And we are here in March of 2026 having these key economic advantages, despite some of those statements made previously. Again, the specifics matter, right? So at each decision, we have to take a look. But I think to recognize where our state has landed. And that kind of brings me to that right towards the end, recognizing the factors of productivity, which I think ends up being really key for us in addition to international migration and as much domestic migration as we can get to our very cold state. But those factors too, it seems to me, in fact, maybe we can flip to that slide. It's right near the end. It says building a world-class workforce to grow Minnesota's economy. Those factors, education, workforce training, tech adoption, pathways to high productivity jobs and industries, those two, to my mind, depend on policy and on investments. Not entirely. There's other things, too. Thank you. Mr. Chair, thanks for the time. I appreciate Ms. Shothorst.
Thank you. Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Ms. Shothorst. A question for you would be around entrepreneurship, new businesses, and innovation, and just curious what chamber information, statistics, and trends we can point to as it relates to how the state is doing in comparison to our neighbors on fostering growth in small businesses in the state.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we do have a report on entrepreneurship on our website that you can take a look at. And we do track some of those metrics and data in our reporting. I don't have those particular numbers in front of me, so I will have to get back to you. I'm sure we can get back to you. Some of the things that we highlight in that type of a data set is Minnesota's five-year business survival rate, which is pretty high ranking. So if you get to the fifth year in Minnesota, we put you through a lot in those first 5 years, but if you get to the fifth year, that's a good statistic. We want to make sure that the first 5 years are easier for businesses to start. But I'll get back to you on the specific data.
Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Ms. Schotthorst. Then thinking about your report here, one of the greatest strengths is how diverse by nature our entire economy is, that we're not reliant upon any one industry and broadly speaking have many different places for workers to go and find a good job that pays them well, that supports their family. And thinking about that, thinking about the next 5 to 10 years, in what areas should we be looking to invest and see greater growth and opportunity for people in our state's economy?
Ms. Schotthorst.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Schultz. There is additional information in some of our reports that look to demonstrate some of those high growth areas in our economy. We have a 2030 report that does contain a lot of identification of trends and different industries. I think one of the things that we hear a lot is the role of technology, and people think tech as in a tech company, but every industry has a tech component of it: ag tech, fintech, ed tech, med tech, things like that. So looking into, you know, foundational digital AI, you know, computer literacy is going to be critical so that workers across any industry, you can be positioned to move between industries because those core skills will be transferable across industries. We are the state's association for manufacturing. So, of course, we always love anything and everything manufacturing, which is a really important component of our economy and has a significant growth potential, too. But I think if you look at some of the data on high growth opportunities, you see manufacturing, construction, education, healthcare are some of the industry specific, but then again, tech across all of those.
All right, follow up, Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As you think about how technology is going to advance and as AI or automation continues to advance in our world, are you at all concerned about the impacts that that's going to play for workers, or could you share a lens to which you think there might be growth opportunities for the state and for its workers?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I believe we have a report on automation and productivity as well on our website. So just a big shout out to our foundation for the work that they're doing on analyzing the research and doing the research on trends in our economy. In terms of AI and automation, the potential is tremendous for everyone for a variety of reasons. You see a lot of discussion with our members about how it's enhancing jobs, not replacing jobs. There's probably going to be elements that are displaced as a result of a new technology shift, of course, but a lot of the feedback we've received so far, and it's changing rapidly, so, you know, we're trying to keep up with what our members are telling us too as it's being deployed across the economy, is that it's being used to enhance workers' work experience so that those workers can move up within their companies. So the investments are a company-wide decision to allow workers to have more meaningful or creative jobs to help support the company versus some of the tasks that could be automated, is a general trend that we're hearing about.
Anything else, Representative Schultz?
Just a final comment, yep. Mr. Chair. I think when I think about the future for Minnesota's workforce, the number one thing that I'm thinking about is the advancement of technology and automation and AI. And while I'm very excited about some of the potential opportunities, I would just want to center us always around people, the workers themselves, the small business owners, the people most impacted. And so I really, the more that we as a legislature can think about that, can talk about that, centered around people, I think is going to be super beneficial for us. And I know that so many people. It doesn't matter the lens through which you're working. If you're at a headquarters economy business, if you're in a small business like your business or my business, Mr. Chair, or whether you're a worker providing and producing within one of those businesses, I think this is the top issue at the top of their minds. And the more that we can do to talk about it, to be, you know, be very comprehensive in our approach to ensure that it is benefiting Minnesotans is going to be beneficial for us. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Final member question for this one is Representative Pete Johnson.
Thank you, Chair Baker. I do have a couple of things. You talked a little bit how the last 2 years we've actually seen domestic net migration come up a little bit and then come up a significant amount. We've also seen international domestic or international migration increase as well. Do you guys have anything, like, as those people are coming in, have you had, like, through your members and everything else, done any polling on what's driven them to Minnesota?
Ms. Shadhorst?
That's a good question. I would have to go back to our department to see what goes into the full body of their research collection methods.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Chair Baker. I'd be curious if it's any of the things that this legislature did in 23 and 24, right? ESST, paid family medical leave, missed class, non-competes, trans refuge, funding education, linking it to inflation, making college more reality, like Chair Pinto talked about. Like, I think we have to acknowledge, I would love to hear the chamber acknowledge that some of those things actually bring people to Minnesota because they see that this is a state that actually cares about their workers, to Representative Schultz's point, and is actually doing things that make their lives better, make their lives easier. The other part I want to hit on too is, you talked about some of those push factors, why people are leaving, right? Cost of living, accessible housing, childcare, and tax competitiveness. And I think we all agree that, like, making lives more affordable for everyday Minnesotans is super important. Making sure that housing is available, not just for workers, but for folks who are experiencing homelessness. Making sure childcare is available for every worker in our economy so that they can continue to be in that workforce and participate in that workforce so they don't have to leave to go home and take care of kids. What I didn't hear is some of the things that are making our lives less affordable. Some of the tariffs, you'll get gas prices right now with the war in Iran. The cutting of care services, whether that's the $250 million that we saw cut in Medicaid, whether it is the CCAP threats that are going to cripple some of these child care centers that are on that knife's edge, some of the restrictions in housing on transitional housing that HUD put on that are going to make more people homeless and make it harder to provide that housing. Like, where is the chamber helping push back against those things? Because some of the most vulnerable people in our society, our workers, some of our most vulnerable workers are currently and will continue to be put in that really hard spot where they won't be able to participate in the workforce.
Mr. Shadhorst.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, what our members tell us is they are looking to grow their operations and invest in other states more so than Minnesota because of the intense tax and regulatory climate here. And so when we're talking about ways that employment can be increased in Minnesota, the regulatory and tax environment does have a direct impact. When looking at some of those other metrics you mentioned, when we were debating the paid family medical leave, if you look at the states that have mandated paid leave, every state but one had a decline in population. So it's not causation and correlation if you're looking at those things, but states that had mandated paid leave programs did not see increased migration trends in those states. So there's a number of reasons why people choose to move to one state or another. State policy may or may not be a factor in that. And to the point earlier, we haven't specifically asked those direct questions, but it's a good question to ask, and I think it's something we should be looking at.
Any final?
One quick thing. Yeah. Thank you, Chair. We do talk about economic growth. It's one of the responsibilities of this committee. I just hope that when we talk about it, it's in a way that isn't outpaced, where the richest folks continue to make more and those lowest incomes folks continue to drop further and further down. Thank you.
Thank you. And again, I made the mistake by saying you were the last one on the list. And all of a sudden, I've got a few more here. So I just want to say I've got three more on the list. I'm going to ask you to be very brief about this, members, because we need to move on to other presenters. So Representative Bakeberg.
Thank you, Chair Baker. Thank you, Ms. Shahorst, for being here. So on the legislative priorities here, you talk about taxes and the conforming to the pro-growth tax policies contained within the federal tax bill. Can you just high level give some specific examples that you're hearing from your members that would help business growth in Minnesota if we would conform to those pro-growth tax policies?
Ms. Shadhorst.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm going to read from the it's small font, and I am not the tax person for our organization, but the areas that we've highlighted, and we have done an analysis on a cost basis to be mindful of the budgets and all of those things to really be focused on the three particular provisions relating to bonus depreciation, Section 179 expensing, and the research and experimentation expensing provisions, as well as the pass-through deductions.
Representative Baikberg.
Thank you. Final. Yep, I'll wrap it up. So it really reminded me when I read that, and then as you were speaking and you were talking about growth opportunities to Representative Johnson's question, when we were out at a business in Bloomington this fall, and that CEO was as blunt as I've ever heard a CEO, and I'm guessing Chair Pinto, Co-Chair Pinto remembers that conversation, about the regulatory environment in Minnesota, and they are what that business was very clear is they would keep their facility in Bloomington, but their growth and development was going to be outside of Minnesota because of the tax and regulatory environment of the state. Not my words, that is that CEO's words as well. On a very local level, one of my constituents recently reached out and he said, Ben, if we would conform to the federal tax, to the federal bill, it would allow me to reinvest the $65,000 into my business, into my workers. And that's really the environment that we're trying to see. And this is a small size business that wants to reinvest, and he has a choice. He can either pay the taxes or he can invest in his workers. And I would hope that we continue to move forward to allow him to invest in his workers.
Thank you, Representative Zlesnikar.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you for the report. My question is on also kind of on the net migration. I'm glad to see that we had a positive swing. My question is, do we have any more data? Because the chart talked about the college students leaving, not coming back. We are losing that workforce. So I'm curious if we have any data on the ages, the salaries of the growth. Where is it? Is it retired people? Is it working class people? What are their annual incomes? That's one of my questions. If you could answer that.
Ms. Shadhorst.
Mr. Chair, and members of the committee, I don't think I can answer that right now, but I'll take that back to our folks to see what information we can have.
Okay. Rep. Zlesnikar.
Thank you, Chair. And my second question is on this data is the last IRS data report that talked about money coming into Minnesota or leaving Minnesota was from the 22 report. And that stated that it was a significant swing of the amount of money that income that left Minnesota. And in 2017, it was $215 million of income left Minnesota. And we see the states that they're going to. But in 2022, I was shocked to see in that the last report the IRS did, it was $219 billion of income left Minnesota. That means investing in restaurants, investing in shopping, in experiences. So I'm curious to see if you have any ideas if that's going to grow when the next report goes in, if it's going to look better than this with the net migration.
To the testifier.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, again, I would have to get back to you. I don't have that information in front of me, and I'm not sure how and if we've analyzed and collected information on that.
Okay, final. Representative Hussein.
I'll keep my question short. Thank you for being here, and thanks for providing this wonderful presentation. I see that Minnesota continue to have more jobs opening.
Representative Hussein, would you want to pull that in a little bit more on the mic? Thank you.
I do see that there's more jobs opening in our state in your presentations. So I was just curious, what's the biggest barrier preventing people to filling for this position?
to the testifier.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, what we hear from our members is a fundamental readiness to work as being a barrier. So those soft skills, and then it moves into the technical skills that folks have. So there can be a mismatch in what folks are prepared to do and how they show up. So some of our strategy for, you know, developing the workforce includes into the K-12 system, building more work readiness preparation and having a more nimble response to the skills that your employers are asking for. We have business education networks. Again, the foundation has a workforce, a bunch of workforce initiatives. They work in local communities with local chambers and schools and higher ed institutions to really be specific to the region that you're in terms of keeping folks not just in Minnesota, but locally. And they're really attuned to the skills and the credentials or the competencies that are necessary in those settings. So they're called business education networks. You heard Representative Mueller have a bill earlier today on that sort of a framework approach. But generally speaking, it's the attitude towards work, the readiness to work, and then some of the skill mismatches. And when employers need to invest heavily into things that they believe should already be if workers should be competent in, that then leads less ability to invest in some of those higher skills.
So. Thank you very much. Anything follow up?
I was just curious, like, what can we do in state level to kind of, you know, we're sitting in the workforce, and I am a bit too frustrated in my district when it comes to workforce. People are not, you know, getting the skills and the jobs that an opportunity that needs. Some of them applying jobs and they're not, you know, hiring. So how do we work together as a state? And, you know, if you have any ideas, like
Ms. Shadhorst.
Mr. Chair, members,
or certificate trainings, or
Mr. Chair, members of the committee. So the workforce development system and the partnerships that you know, for example, DEED has through their programming, there are some improvements that could be made on flexibility. It might require legislative tweaks as to what's eligible for those expenses or those partnerships. We look at the ease for, you know, businesses wanting to engage in these partnerships, and sometimes they can be complicated and cumbersome. So the mechanics and the administration of state programming, I know there's a lot of discussion amongst the legislature about how best to give state money and the oversight and things like that. But barrier to, you know, forming those public-private partnerships, I think everyone is looking for a better process there. And then in terms of how you're fundamentally building a workforce that starts in the K-12 level, and we think there's a need to put, you know, foundational computer science in a more meaningful way, building those pathways. Experiential hands-on learning pathways is critical. And, you know, we have those business education networks. It's hard to get them going because of the structure of state policy and bureaucracies and territorial nature of education versus economic development. And so de-siloing some of those things and allowing for, you know, the needs of the economy and the skills that are, you know, required in the workforce to be achieved earlier in the education continuum is one of the things. We can talk more specifically.
Right. And to that, again, that was a big question. We're going to leave it at that. So we're going to move on to the next presenter. But thank you, Ms. Shadhorst, for that. There's a lot of information here, a lot of good information. Thank you. And members, thank you for the very good conversation about this today, too. So thank you for the presentation. I'm going to invite Mr. Spry to come to the testimony table. Mr. Spry is a professor from the University of Minnesota. And he's St. Thomas. I'm sorry. It's a university. I go right there. Go Tommies. Okay, I better say that online. Mr. Spry, welcome to the committee, and when you are set up, we will let you move forward and introduce yourself and proceed. Thank you.
Thank you. Hello, my name is John Spry, and I'm a professor in the Opus College of Business at St. Thomas, and my testimony is only that of a private citizen from St. Paul, not my employer, and any errors are my own. And
as was the chair's earlier, so thank you.
If you're an economist, that's usually how you begin, is I'm not blaming anybody else for my errors. So the first thing I wanted to look at is probably the best measure, and we had some reference in the chamber presentation, is we used to be 10th in the nation for per capita GDP. And so in 1997, we were several thousand dollars ahead of the U.S. average. And I put our North Dakota neighbors in green, and I have also Iowa in black and South Dakota in red, and the Badgers are in their home white color on my graph. And as we go through time, you can see by 2014, we're roughly in the same place. We have had economic growth. Economic growth has been about the same. We were down to 11th, and we had a $6,000 gap 12 years ago. And now, by the last available data for a whole year, 2024, we're basically at the nation's average. So a Lake Wobegon effect of our per capita GDP being above the national average. That's the way Minnesota used to be. The Twins used to win the World Series, but our GDP growth has been like watching the Twins for about the last dozen years. No, but it has been a little bit slower than the average. And the other thing is, as you look at this, you see some of our neighbors are very tied to commodities, agriculture commodities, and obviously for North Dakota, energy. But what I wanted to present especially is about our high effective net marginal tax rates, which is one of these academic ideas. And what this is not how much do you pay. You get a tax incidence study for some of the taxes Minnesotans pay to Minnesota state and local government. The CBO produces tax incidence for federal taxes. That includes things like tax expenditures, deductions, credits that people receive. A marginal tax rate is what happens if you, since I'm a college professor, give it the old college try and you work harder, or you get off the bench and you enter the labor force and you get a job. At the margin, incrementally, when you change your behavior to have higher gross income, what is your tax rate? And what we'll see is many Minnesotans face marginal tax rates that can approach and even exceed 50%. And that's both because of the layers of taxes and because we have a mishmash of social service programs with benefit phase-outs. We also have phase-outs in our tax code. So one of the things I'm going to show you that's a comparison is for 30 to 39-year-olds, when you do all in, the effective marginal tax rate for people in our bottom 20% is 45.5%. So we are tied for the fifth highest, or in my view, the fifth worst marginal tax rate for people in the bottom 20%. And I want to point out, I'm quoting Berkeley and Boston University professors here, that in addition to the deadweight loss normally associated with distortions to labor supply by tax and transfer systems, we have considerable additional losses coming from the dispersion of marginal tax rates. I hope to teach you what that is and so show you some graphs about that. And so what higher tax rates can do is a lot more things than just interstate mobility. and going to a different state. High tax rates give you a huge incentive to time taxable transactions to occur in years with lower tax rates. There's a whole industry, and there's a strong incentive from high tax rates to rearrange your financial and accounting transactions. And it's completely legal. It's completely ethical. You don't have to arrange things to pay any more taxes than you legally owe. But people can do this in a variety of ways. So a very simple one is if you're a Minnesotan and you have your money in a Minnesota bank and you have a savings account, a checking account, you pay tax on that interest. If you move that money into U.S. Treasuries or a U.S. Treasury fund, Minnesota doesn't tax you. It can't. It doesn't have the power to tax. So when you have higher tax rates, you've created more of an incentive, not just thinking about moving across state lines. I actually think that's a small part of the distortions from high tax rates. It's all these other decisions. There's a huge disincentive to support. I shouldn't say huge. There's a significant incentive to supply additional efforts of labor or enter the labor force in the first place if you're facing a marginal tax rate of 100%. That's saying, okay, your family doesn't actually benefit from this decision to provide more labor. That's a big disincentive. There's a disincentive for education and on-the-job training. If you don't get to keep all that much of what you make by working more or working with better skills. For our people up north, you know, iron miners have disagreeable jobs. Most people would say more disagreeable than, say, white-collar jobs or university professor jobs. There generally is a premium for that. Higher tax rates blunt the reward for taking a riskier, more disagreeable jobs. There's a strong incentive to take compensation in tax-preferred forms. There's a lot of planning that goes into this, both from workers and from their employers. And there's also a disincentive to marry if you're going to marry into a tax and benefit penalty. So here is the map, and again, I have the source. This is a National Bureau of Economic Research working paper. We're at 45.5%, and that's at the median for the lowest 20% of our workers between 30 and 39. And that's quite high. So that is very specific to Minnesota. In their study, they broke things out in a lot more detail for national numbers. And I should point out, this is out of date. It is a huge task to try to computerize and add up all of these tax rates and phase outs that raise marginal tax rates. And so they did this based on the 2018 law. And so you can see, here, overall for the country, the median marginal tax rate is about 43%. So you make another $1,000. That's good. $430 goes to all the layers of government taxing you, and you get to keep $570. Looking across, it's monotonically increasing in where you are in the lifetime resource quintile. So if you're in the top, if you're in the top 1%, that's, and again, this is 2018, about 58%, and that's at the median. What I want to point out is there's a large dispersion. A large variation in this. And again, I should point out this is also for people 20 to 69, which is most of your labor force. So if you look at total lifetime resources on the x-axis and your lifetime marginal tax rate, you're going to find something that, quite frankly, to anybody listening at home, almost sounds unbelievable, which is there are Minnesotans, there are Americans that have an effective marginal tax rate over 100%. How is that possible? Well, you add up everything, and some of this is sales tax. So I live in St. Paul. We have a 9.875% sales tax. You have some payroll taxes. You may have some income tax. A lot of this is phase outs. And as we look across, consistent with the last graph, the lifetime marginal effective tax rate tends to increase with your lifetime resources, your lifetime earnings, your lifetime income, right? But you can see here for the high income, there's less dispersion. That is, their effective marginal tax rates tend to be closer together. But if we look here for people with the lowest lifetime earnings, lowest lifetime resources, you can see the dispersion. So if I go on to the next graph, it's a simpler version of what we saw before. So if I start out looking on the far right, for all Americans in 2018, you can see that the mean and median are kind of similar there, around 43%, 44%. But there's dispersion. And if you look at within all Americans, the top 10% of Americans have, and again, this is not by income, this is by marginal tax rate, have a marginal tax rate just under 60%, which means they go to work, they put in some overtime, they make another $1,000 for their family, $590 go to the government, $410 goes to that family. That's what a marginal tax rate means. That's very high. If you look at the low group at the 25th quintile, so that border between lower, that's much lower, around 35%. So this is what I mean by dispersion. And if we look at the top 1%, you can see there's some dispersion, but it's fairly small. The difference between that 25th quintile, that's just under 50%, and the 90th quintile, that's 70%, that's only a 20% difference. And that's a pretty wide part of the distribution. Now let's look. And one of the things I'll just tell you, I'm not the Chamber of Commerce. I really like workers. I like workers to do well. And so I'm going to look, that's my personal policy preference, at the lowest 20%. And you can see the dispersion from the 25th quintile at 25% goes all the way up to where the top 1% had their marginal tax rate at the 90th quintile there of 70%. So that dispersion is more than double. That is, it's a dispersion in marginal tax rate. It is much wider for people in the bottom 20% of resources over their lifetime than it is for people at the top or people overall. And that actually produces an opportunity to do better. Because one of the things I want to show is kind of a standard diagram. Taxes raise revenue. You can see the tax revenue in blue. But they also create efficiency losses. These are all the bad decisions you make because of the taxes. These are people that, in the absence of the tax, would not have put their money in U.S. Treasuries, but would have put it in a Minnesota bank or put the money in a Minnesota company as an equity investment. But for tax reasons, they move some money into a Minnesota income tax-free. This is also people not entering the labor force or cutting back on hours worked. And when you have relatively low tax rates, your tax, and it's just mathematics, your tax revenue triangle has a lot of transactions, but it doesn't have much height, right? That's the definition of a low tax rate. You don't have much revenue as you move to higher tax rate, As you move to a higher tax rate, you can see the tax revenue becomes higher. You have a higher tax rate. You lose some transactions at the margin. You do not lose everything, right? It's a marginal effect as you raise a tax rate. But when you go to really high tax rates, and we saw, particularly for people in the bottom 20% of resources, they have some very high tax rates, you get people that find out that it's better off to not be in the labor force. That additional income, I earn an extra $1,000, congratulations, my family is, say, $50 worse off. That is a bad thing. And so what the professors and economist David Altig et al. Find is just in the lowest 20% of workers or for lifetime resources, the dispersion in tax rates creates a deadweight loss that is something like 9 to 24% of their labor income. Meaning, and again, this is very hard to do, not one committee can do this because it's both federal and state. But imagine if I go back here, the lowest 20%, they all had the same effective marginal tax rate of, say, 43%, instead of a dispersion where some are at 25%, some are at 70, some are even over 100%. Because tax rates are quadratic in the damage they cause, for people in this low-income category, the deadweight loss we would eliminate if we had better treatment of our tax code and phase-outs would be, in magnitude, really economically meaningful, maybe something like 9 to 24% of their labor income, which would be a huge welfare gain, and that's without changing tax revenue. That's just changing, to use a Ronald Reagan, Hubert Humphrey idea, to have a simpler, broader, and lower tax and phase-out plan than what we had, and these are the numbers from 2018. So thank you for hearing me, and I'd be happy to take your questions.
Mr. Spry, thank you very much. This is a very in-depth presentation, and thank you. This is a different way of looking at things. You're really, really tearing apart how taxes and the tax decisions that we all make really affect us, and I think sort of your best rate of return for those taxes, and I think this is getting into something. From your analysis of all of this, then, giving us sort of your parting words, what is your main recommendation of this committee and how we can kind of work towards, again, having us make sure that we maximize those marginal tax rates that you're talking about?
Oh, I want to minimize the marginal tax rate subject to meeting the revenue that people think we need to have. And so what that means is try to avoid, right? If you really understand this, this is actually kind of a horror show, is you have families where working more up here, they have these really high marginal tax rates. You also have some, and it's worth pointing out when I was talking about dispersion, you have some families where their marginal tax rate is zero or it can even be negative. And this happens by adding up and stacking all the levels, not just of the taxes, but the phase out. So I have an example here from Hennepin County. And this is only, right, I don't even have any taxes on here. I only have benefit programs other than the EITC. And what happens on the top graph, we have programs where there's a cliff. And one of the things I've heard a lot since I'm a college professor, I paid attention a lot to what we've done to college. One of the things we have created in Minnesota that's not in here is once you go over the income threshold, you are off of the free tuition at the University of Minnesota. That is a massive phase out. And in our other programs, you can see at the top, oh, you're off the program. That creates these cliffs where by trying to work more, you actually have fewer resources for your family. And so this seems to be pretty well known in the academic world. It's not something I hear very much in the public discourse. And it gives you an opportunity, again, like the hypothetical here on my last slide, is just the bottom 20% of people. We collect the same amount of taxes and transfers from them as we do now. We just equalize the marginal tax rate to get rid of the extreme high and the extreme low. That reduces economic inefficiency, just complete bad decisions by something that's around 9 to 23% of this group's labor income. That's a great thing if you're able to do it. I don't think that's possible the way committees work, but if you could do a little bit of that, that would be something that could really meaningfully help our Minnesota workers.
Thank you. Final comments from Chair Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you so much. Professor Spry is a constituent of mine, so glad to have you, especially glad to have you here. I appreciate, maybe you could flip to the slide showing the benefits, Cliff. Yeah, I so much appreciate you highlighting this issue because I think that folks, so many of our social service agencies are very well aware of benefits cliffs and of the challenge. I don't see this slide in the materials we received. Maybe you can send it later.
Yeah, I can add this later. I added it thinking about things to try to explain how this works. And this doesn't like have any sales tax. It doesn't have any other taxes.
Yeah. And Mr. Chair, thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, so receiving that would be great because I do think that having us all focus on benefit cliffs and on the challenge that folks experience, I guess what's coming to my mind is the difference in how we treat learning. This is an issue especially important to me. In K-12 education, families just get it. There is no benefit cliff, right? Whatever your income is, you get it. It's not something we have to deal with or be affected by. Below age 5, we know that there's significant benefits cliffs that kick in that actually end up impacting the workforce quite significantly as folks cannot afford childcare and early learning. And so anyway, eager to continue looking into this, but I so much appreciate you highlighting the impact, the burden on low-income Minnesotans because of how we've structured various programs. Mm-hmm. So thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much. Mr. Spry, thank you very much for your testimony today. We really appreciate this information. And folks, if you have any more questions, you can certainly look it up with the professor at the University of St. Thomas. Thank you very much. And again, I'll invite our final presentation up today. If our folks from SHRM could come up and please take the testimony table. And also you've got a packet, our last presentation is in your packet as well, members, so you can pull that up. Welcome to the committee. Welcome to, again, our discussion today. Ms. Dickens, please introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony today.
Thank you, Chair Baker and members of the committee. As a guest, I'm going to stick to 5 to 7 minutes, and I ask that you also leverage in your packets. I understand you have our slides, so I'm not even going to put the slides up. It is absolutely a privilege to be here today. I'm Emily M. Dickens. I'm Chief Administrative Officer at SHRM, which is the largest business and trade association in the world for HR professionals and executives. SHRM is a leading convener and thought leader on issues shaping today's workforce. We represent more than 340,000 HR professionals globally, including 5,200 members in the state of Minnesota, who are responsible for recruiting, developing, and supporting the workforce that powers organizations across the state. HR professionals sit at the intersection of workplace policy and workforce reality, and every day they're responsible not only for implementing workplace policy, but also ensuring their organizations can recruit, develop, and retain the talent that they need to grow. That vantage point gives HR leaders a unique perspective on one of the most pressing workforce challenges facing our country and our states today, strengthening the connection between education and employment. Across the country and here in Minnesota, employers are navigating a growing disconnect between how talent is prepared and what the modern workforce needs. At SHRM, we often say this is less a labor shortage and more a redesign of work itself. Jobs are evolving faster than the systems that prepare people for them. And according to SHRM research, 28% of organizations report that filling full-time roles now require new skills. And nearly half of these roles are existing jobs that have been modified to include capabilities such as data analysis, artificial intelligence, and cybersecurity. Or put another way, we don't just have open jobs, we have evolving jobs. When jobs change faster than education pathways and workforce systems, mismatch becomes the predictable outcome. National labor force trends reinforce this shift. SHRM research being published this month has found that since 1985, the employment share of non-student youth has fallen from 14.4% to just 8% in 2025, reflecting a long-term disconnect between early workforce attachment and employment pathways. At SHRM, we describe this challenge across three key workforce pipelines. First, the K-12 pipeline, where students may graduate without exposure to the workplace expectations and power skills that employers consistently identify as critical. Second, the higher education pipeline, where graduates leave with strong academic preparation but may lack applied workplace experience. And third, the untapped talent pipeline, where individuals who are capable and ready to work but remain disconnected from employment opportunities. Strengthening the connection between these pipelines is central to building a workforce that works for both employers and workers. The encouraging news is that employers are already adapting. Across the country, we're seeing a growing skills-first movement in hiring and workforce development. According to SHRM research, 78% of HR professionals report that skills credentials are now used regularly in hiring decisions, and 87% report encountering applicants with these credentials, reflecting the rapid growth of alternative pathways into the workforce. When discussing how employers are responding to this moment, I often talk about what I call the shifts. That includes internships, apprenticeships, and partnerships that connect individuals to meaningful career pathways. These shifts create cultural and structured opportunities for individuals to gain real workplace experience while helping employers build stronger talent pipelines. For example, while only about 22% of organizations currently operate apprenticeship programs, among those that do, 82% report they are effective at addressing talent shortages. Similarly, nearly 7 in 10 organizations now offer internship programs, and 78% report that they are effective at strengthening their talent pipelines. These pathways also expand opportunity for untapped talent, including opportunity youth, individuals with disabilities, and others who've historically faced barriers to employment. Untapped talent does not need charity, it needs a clear pathway. To help strengthen these connections nationally and at the state level, SHRM has launched the Education to Employment, or E-Square, initiative. It is designed to strengthen the pathways between education systems and the workforce by focusing on three key areas: awareness, helping educators better understand the evolving expectations of the workplace and the power skills employers consistently identify as essential; advocacy, working with policymakers to modernize workforce and education policies so they reflect the realities of today's labor market; and action, building partnerships between employers, schools, and community organizations to expand work-based learning opportunities such as the SHIPS and other hands-on or experiences that help students transition successfully into careers. At its core, this initiative recognizes that employers must be active partners in shaping talent pipelines. Minnesota has long been recognized for its strong workforce and high levels of labor force participation, especially as it relates to the Midwest. But maintaining that strength requires ensuring that education and workforce systems remain aligned with the needs of employers and the evolving economy. For HR leaders across Minnesota, the goal is simple: ensuring that students, job seekers, and workers have access to clear pathways into meaningful careers, while employers have access to the talent they need to grow and compete. The E-Square framework provides an opportunity to strengthen those connections, bringing educators, employers, and policymakers together to build a more responsive workforce ecosystem. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much, Ms. Dickens. I know on our agenda we have another testifier, but we're going to pass on that at this point unless there's any technical questions, I think, is what our plan is, just for out of respect for our time with a few minutes left. This is really interesting. Again, I like the SHIP program. Again, it's about internships, partnerships. I think that what we have been seeing around Minnesota, at least for a number of years that I've been really engaged in this, is that we get much, much better results when the partnerships really accelerate, the internships, and especially the private industry, when they get involved in these kind of things, we are having a lot better return on our investments. Our employees are coming out better, stronger, especially our young students. So this has been really helpful. Thank you for this. I have Representative Mueller as a question for you, our education person, so buckle up for this one.
This is, thank you, Chair Baker, and not really a question, just a comment. Yeah. I really appreciate your presentation. This is why I have House File 3650. This is the reason why we have, that has our agencies working together to make sure that we have a framework for career, student career pathways. And, you know, you said in your presentation that employers have to be there to help build the pipelines. We need DLI, DEED, to be working with MDE, to also be working with OHE, with credit equivalencies and those things. We have to have it. And so this is the reason for that bill. And I'm really excited for some of the things that we'll be able to do in the future. Thank you, Chair Baker.
Thank you, Representative. Member questions. Chair Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, and I really appreciate the presentation as well. As somebody who's not a professional background in this area, I appreciate you laying out the three pipelines and what the challenges are in each. I guess maybe just a request is that you would follow up with us in your advocacy section under E squared as to kind of specific policies you are suggesting. And in particular, I'd love to fold this into the, Mr. Chair, the system reform task force that we're mm-hmm. looking at to just get a sense as to what some of the recommendations you all have are to address the challenges of each of those three pipelines. So thank you, Mr. Chair, for bringing in the testifier, and thanks so much for your work.
Thank you very much. Any other member questions? Seeing none, that was really great. Thank you, Ms. Dickinson, for, again, sharing your thoughts with us today. We look forward to more conversations down the road. Thank you so much. Members, with that concludes our agenda items. Mr. Chair, what are we looking at for next week?
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Schultz was prescient in his earlier comment about AI and technology, because that will be the focus on Tuesday, is AI and the impact on our workforce and a few ideas to start exploring, because this is a really critical issue. Thank you.
That's good. We're getting a lot of information and updates on that. I'm looking forward to that at 8:15 a.m. on Tuesday. Here we go. I just want to remind everybody of that. With that, members, we have concluded and we are adjourned.